Welcome to this episode of Against the Mountains of Madness. I'm your host, Jason.
And I'm your host, John Wright.
And today we're going to be talking about beauty. What is it, why it matters, and what's gone wrong. So, John, beauty, it's part of the triumvirate of the true, the good, and the beautiful. What is it? Isn't it just in the eye of the beholder, as they say?
I always thought that the idea that beauty was in the eye of the beholder was a really ugly idea. And it's not one I ever agreed with, because it looks to me like if that were true, then there'd be no such thing as learning to see beauty where you didn't see it at first. Learning to see beauty where you didn't see it at first would just be a matter of your tastes changing, not a matter of you actually discovering something that was there. But I know from my own experience of doing things like reading poetry that I didn't understand when I was young and that I did understand when I got older, that there is something there that I discovered. It's not just a matter of me changing my point of view, you see. So even a cursory familiarity with beauty will tell you that it can't just be in the eye of the beholder, because I submit it to you as a empirical experiment. If beauty were in the eye of the beholder, then the things that are currently in modern art museums would seem beautiful to the beholders, and they do not, you see.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Some people seem that, well, they gush about it and say it's amazing and wonderful and insightful and
right.
Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Do you duct tapes a banana to a wall.
Do you believe them? Do you think they're telling the truth?
I think they're insane, so they probably believe what they're saying.
Ah, okay. If an insane man says something, is he telling the truth? Do his words reflect reality? If a man out of touch with reality says something that he thinks is there, and it's not there, is it there?
No, but they believe, but they potentially believe it. Like, if you see the distinction, like I'm happy to contend.
I'm afraid I don't.
I agree. I agree. They're mistaken, but I think they may be honestly mistaken, perhaps as a symptom of their madness.
Well, let's put it to the test as to whether it's honestly mistaken. Whether or not the question is whether or not you think they're honest or whether they're insane when they say these things. Now,
yes.
I'm willing to give a certain amount of leeway to people who simply have different tastes or to people who are from other cultures who appreciate things I can't see, such as non-diatonic music. Granted. But one of the works of art that's currently hanging in an art museum is Marcel Duchamp's Fountain from 1917, which is a urinal. Can you look at a urinal and say, this is beauty? I have the same profound, emotional, sublime reaction to this, the same honest reaction as I have to the shining thunder of a waterfall, the glorious purity of the morning star rising in the morning before the sun, the songs of birds, the symphonies of Beethoven, scenes of stallions running against a green plain, the beauty of a woman, a dance, anything. Honestly, could a person, if a person looks at a urinal and sees the same thing you or I see looking at mountains or women or Greek cathedrals or a statue of David, is there something wrong with them? Is that a proper response for a human being?
Yeah. Yes, I think there's something wrong with them. Although
it does strike
me that there's when you compare them to waterfalls, there's definitely a joke about flushing them in there somewhere. So.
Sure, as a joke. Clearly, Marcel Duchamp put a urinal in the museum as a joke. It was meant to shock and alarm the viewers, the people in the museum. Now, Martin Creed did something called Work Number 227, Lights Going On and Off. This was in the year 2000, and it's a Turner Prize winner. It consists of a light going on and off. Okay. Damon Hirst had something called A Thousand Years from 1990. It's a maggoty cow head. It's a cow head, a severed cow head covered with maggots. Michael Craig Martin did a work of art called An Oak Tree from 1973. It's a glass of water sitting on a shelf. I mean, do I need to go on? These things are deliberately inculcated so as to offend the senses, so as to shock the bourgeoisie values. If beauty were in the eye of the beholder, these things would not be shocking. I would be able to buy an act of will to see them as beautiful as seeing as when I look at a laughing child or a butterfly, you know, or a pristine white mountain, or anything else that you regard as beautiful. You see. Now, having said that, I do think there's some variation of tastes. Some men prefer redheads to blondes. Okay, as I said at the beginning, there's some education of the taste. I don't think that you can just pick up Milton and read him with full enjoyment if you're not familiar with the classical models that he's both basing his poem on and riffing off of. You know, and if you're not familiar with the Bible stories, you're not going to get some of his allusions, some of his references. Likewise, if you read the Iliad in translation, you're going to be dependent on how good the translator is, for example.
Of course.
Whereas if you actually take the time to learn Greek, you'll see it in its original. Even then, you won't see it in the way that the audience at the time saw it. But you should, unless your soul is dead, see some of the greatness and some of the beauty in it. So if someone can't see the beauty in a beautiful thing, I submit that that means there's something wrong with them, not that they're merely have a difference of opinion with me, you see. Let me mention, Piero Manzoni's artist is called Artist Shit. It's from 1961. It is a can of excrement. Can you think of anything more clearly meant to shock the senses rather than to uplift the senses to the sublime? And Tracy Emin's My Bed from 1998 is an unmade bed. She put her unmade bed into an art museum.
Well, I mean...
A dirty bed. A urinal. A can of shit. A glass of
what's
water.
What's bizarre?
Oh, I didn't mention Piss Christ. It's a crucifix dunked in urine.
Yes.
Now, the only appeal of that is to blaspheme the Christ. That's why it's there. You know, there's no work of art that has a Koran dunked in urine that's on display in our museum. I notice.
Well, I suppose in the artist's defense there, Muslims have a habit of cutting heads off when people do things like that. I'm not going to say us Catholics should start doing that, but maybe we should get more incensed and not take it lying down. I suppose we're obliged to turn the other cheek, which lets the artist live.
Maybe, but that's not the question. The question is it beautiful because the artist says so?
No, of course not.
In order for the artist to be correct that it's beautiful, he would have to say that he has the authority to declare something to be beautiful. And then if I don't see it as beautiful, there's something wrong with me, you see. That his inner authenticity, his inner voice, his inner glow is so great that he can override all conventional conclusions on this point and dismiss 3,000 years or 4,000 years of human tradition. Now, since I like certain cave paintings, let me also say, you know, 500,000 years of human artistic tradition. Art is older than history, is older than writing, okay?
Yeah.
So, if art is in the eye of the beholder, none of the artist has the ability like God himself to simply decree something into existence. He can take a literal can of excrement and say, "I decree this to be beautiful," and he's right, and he'd be right. You see?
I saw an interesting meme the other day. I'll see if I can find it for the viewers, but it was comparing modern art and classical art.
Mm-hmm.
And it noted the difference between the two was classical art is looking to something higher and seeking something, and it's trying to direct the viewer to something higher and beyond itself.
Right.
And modern art doesn't. And it said, like, how can you compare these, a bunch of really beautiful classical paintings, to these modern artworks? Are any of these modern artworks beautiful at all? And it was the usual sort of a lot of it was just that abstract garbage where it looks like someone's welded some crap together or whatever. Notably, though, two of the pieces of modern art, one of them was a giant rubber ducky floating in a river, and another one was, you know those balloon dogs you make out of the balloon things? It was a big one of those in gold foil. And the question was, oh, which of these, you know, which of these is great of these modern ones? How do they compare? And I was sort of like, well, the rubber ducky was kind of interesting, and I actually liked the balloon dog, but there was nothing ennobling about it. Like, the balloon dog was just kind of neat in a quirky...
it was funny.
Novel. It was just sort of novel, and it was novel
it was
and
funny.
Kind of cute, but it wasn't...
It was a joke.
But there's nothing uplifting about it. It wasn't...
Because it's a joke.
Well, yeah, okay.
Calling it art is a joke, because it's just kind of cute. It's like the kind of thing you'd find in the lair of a Batman villain before he ties the Caped Crusader to a giant penny or something, or has him trampled by, you know, giant toy robots or, you know.
Mm.
But you pointed out the core of the question that you asked me before, and I didn't even attempt to answer, which is, what is beauty? And you pointed out that in days of old, men use beauty to draw you out of your selfish self-perception to look at something greater than yourself, by being more beautiful. I mean, a butterfly is greater than a man in one sense, in that it's not smarter or stronger, but it is more delicate and fair. To remind us that this quotidian world of death and decay, the world of urinals and excrement and unmade beds, is not the only world there is. Plato believed that beauty drew the soul ever upward toward higher and higher things, toward... It used the delight of the senses to draw you to the world beyond your senses, where true delight lay, where the good, the abstract spirit of the good rested, the unmoved mover, the absolute. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, we Christians, Catholics would say, and this is God. Beauty draws you to God. So the question of what is beauty is, beauty is that which... reminds you that this ugly world has something in it that's not ugly. It's kind of an odd definition. I'm just saying beauty is the shining ray of light that breaks through the dust on the window into your jail cell and tells you there's sunlight out there somewhere. You see. Now, here's the reason why I think the moderns and the postmoderns hate beauty, because you can't tell me someone putting a urinal. Or how many of the things I mentioned were scatological, including severed cow heads or unmade beds or a light going off and on, okay? Or deliberately outrageously nihilistic, deliberately outrageously meaningless.
Mm.
They don't want to remind you that there's something beyond the world of crap and. Dead cows and unmade beds. They want you to say that they want to confirm that that's the only world there is. Because beauty, in addition to being the thing that draws you out of yourself, the thing that is beauty is that which is sublime. Okay, is that a fairly good definition? Decoration is something that reminds us of the sublime, but it's not itself sublime. The decoration is pleasant to the eye, but it's not. It doesn't strike you. It's not a life changing experience when you look at wallpaper. But it is more pleasant than, you know, looking at peeling paint or something. Because I think art means something more than just decoration does. Maxfield Parrish, for example, was hired to decorate advertisements, but he created art, and the society recognized that. So what is the other thing beauty is? Beauty is an argument for God. Beauty is a theological argument, because some people are drawn to God because they see things so beautiful. They can't believe it doesn't have a meaning. They can't believe it doesn't have an artist behind it. They can't believe that life is not worth living. They can't believe that life... they can't believe that life only has the meaning man gives to it. They can't believe life is worth living only when man says so and not otherwise. You see, they can't believe that the beauty in things is only what we impose on them by our act of will. They're not egotistical enough to believe the human will can create beauty out of ugliness just by fiat, just by saying so. You see?
Yep.
Well, beauty can save the world, because beauty can draw people out of the ugliness of their sins, because sin is also ugly in addition to being sinful, if you know what I'm saying.
Yep. Yes.
Despite how artfully they try, pornographers painting whores try to make them look beautiful, but they never look as beautiful as a woman in her wedding dress. They never look as beautiful as your true love. Now, admittedly, there is a subjective component to beauty. I see it from my point of view. To me, my wife, no matter what she looks like, is going to be more beautiful than any other woman in the world. But there's also an objective component. Objectively speaking, there's something dead in the eyes of whores and harlots. There's something ugly, no matter how nicely they're painted, in them. They look degraded, you see? And yes. For a lot of people who are addicted to pornography, the degradation becomes the allure. So they want to see something that's actually ugly in order to be sexually stimulated. Well, I believe that the artist who puts dead cow heads or crucifixes dunked in urine or an unmade bed or a flickering light in an art museum is suffering from an analogous disease of the aesthetic perception. We don't have a word. We have a word for the conscience, which allows us to detect right and wrong moral action. And we have a word for the eyeball, which allows us to detect light and the images light carries to us. And we have a word for the reason, which allows us to detect when symbols are either coherent or incoherent with themselves. But we don't have a word for the aesthetic perception. We usually call it taste or something. Now, every other form of perception can be deceived or marred. I can look at a stick that I put into the water and it looks bent to me when it's actually straight. You see? Mm-hmm. I can be deceived about my reasoning. I can make an error in my math, and I often do. I add 2 and 2 and get 22 or something. Well, what makes us think that the aesthetic perception is error-free? That it doesn't have to be trained, that it doesn't have to be sensitized, you know? If that... I submit that it's a sufficient explanation of the difference in tastes in people to say that some people have trained taste and others do not. Some people have an aesthetic reaction to things that remind them of other things in their life, and others do not. So that what appeals to you as beautiful depends much on your background, largely on your background. Especially when you're talking about things like fashion sense. What looks pretty to you that a woman is wearing for a dress? I mean, to me that looks like that's culturally determined. But none of them think that a maimed or mutated woman is covered with that a leper is going to be sexually attractive, you see. So there's a range, there's a limit within which beauty has some play. There's some difference of opinion. Does this mean it's subjective? Well, there's also a range of scientific opinion. Some people say the universe is a steady state, expanding constantly. Some say that it was created a Big Bang. I believe the Big Bang theory is now standard, but at one time that was open to debate. At one time, the geocentric theory as opposed to the heliocentric theory was open to debate. Okay. So. And rock and roll is not to my taste, but that, again, is a matter of taste. Even if I don't like it myself, no, I'll give you another example. I often review science fiction stories for my work. I can see the difference between a well-crafted piece of art when it's well-constructed and when it's not, whether it agrees with my personal taste or not. I can tell the difference between a well-told romance story and a poorly told one, even though romance stories are not my genre. It's not something I admire, you see?
Even though you don't like them.
Even though I don't like them. I can still see what the artist was trying to do and what the appeal is, what his effect was trying to get. See? Now, that's a slightly different topic, because an artist tries to do by artifice, by craft, what nature does naturally. That is to say, we try to reproduce those things that produce the aesthetic reaction in our audience, you know. So as one might say, birds sing, but only men compose songs.
Yep.
So have I carried the day? Have I convinced you that beauty has to be at least partly objective? Or do you think that maybe these guys sincerely believe that a crucifix in urine is really as beautiful as the Mona Lisa or the Venus de Milo or the Statue of David or the Beethoven's Ode to Joy, Schiller's Ode to Joy in Beethoven's Ninth. That same amount of aesthetic experience, the same reaction. is there in the, or is it just meant to be a blasphemy and putting a finger up the nose of the church?
Oh, I think some of them are certainly the latter. It's always impressed me when you hear amusing stories like a modern art sculpture in a museum was thrown out by the cleaner because they thought it was trash.
Let me tell you a real one. It actually happened.
There's a
It
few of
happened just in the
those.
last
There's a
two
few of
years. It
those.
happened in the last 2 years. A guy left his glasses sitting on a bench, and people came up and started commenting on it because they thought it was part of the display. There was a building
Well,
in
there's.
Washington, D.C. that had a piece of modern art sculpture set up outside of it. It was a group of twisted girders, and the workmen came by and removed it once the because they thought it was part of the girder structure they had been using to clean and repair the front of the building.
Yep. Oh, no
So
argument
I
there.
submit that if you
There's lots
can't
of stories like
tell
that.
whether it is art or garbage, then it's garbage. Art is supposed to stand out from decoration. It's supposed to stand out from ordinary fair things and reach into your soul. And I, again, that's not just ineptitude. That's not just I tried to do the Mona Lisa and I drew Charlie Brown, because I just don't have the skill of drawing. That's the artist trying to offend you, trying to jar your aesthetic perceptions, and to produce a reaction of visceral disgust.
Well, so many of them are, I've seen them around university campuses or in public parks and things. They're not even ugly. They just don't make any sense. I mean, okay, maybe I'm missing something, but they seem to be public. Like, I mean, is it too uncharitable to call it a scam? Somebody got paid
No, it's
large sums of money for this garbage, for this stuff that doesn't mean, like, it's extruded metal in a couple of loops chained together or whatever. But I mean, like, somebody got paid for this. This annoys me because
because
if nothing else,
you and I are
how do I get
both
in on the
you and I are both artists and we're not
scam?
getting paid.
Well, I mean,
You want to get in on you want to get on the scam?
I think maybe I'd be willing to get in on the scam. I mean, I don't need to make anything deliberately offensive. I can just, but I'm sure I can make boring crap that doesn't mean anything too. It's not that
What
hard. It doesn't
profits it a
seem
man to sell his soul
that
and gain a few dollars from an art commission? It is a scam. It is not uncharitable to say it is a scam. It
Well, it would let me
absolutely
fund it would
positively is a scam. It's a money laundering scheme. Look at what the son of the current occupant of the White House in the United States is doing in order to get
Yes.
bribes. He's pretending that he's making art when
An artist and
he's
selling.
literally blowing paint through a straw. I mean, you can tell there's no craft because they avoid craft. They avoid using any craftsmanship to do their performance, shall we say. Okay.
Oh,
Now the
and
problem is that
performance
it's
art.
like
Oh my
anything else.
goodness.
Tearing down a monument is not the same as building a monument. Okay?
Of
They
course.
both change something, but if you draw a picture and it hangs in an art museum for 30 years before someone finds out it has been hung upside down, the craft you have brought to the painting is the same as that of my fourth grader bringing home a piece of artwork from arts and crafts class that I hang on my refrigerator to please him. Okay?
It's not the same though.
How is it?
That's
How is it?
different.
How if it requires no craft and does not produce any aesthetic effect, how is it different from what a 5-year-old does?
Well, no, I was going to say the art the 5-year-old brings home does produce an aesthetic effect, and you appreciate that they tried and that they're not very skilled at their craft, but they're doing their
Well,
best.
it's because you love your kids.
Well, that too, but I mean, like, but there's an appreciation for, oh, it's impressive that they've managed. I mean, okay, I have a special needs stepson,
Sure.
and some of the things he draws, he's basically a toddler, a 21-year-old toddler.
Yeah.
But some of the stuff he draws is actually, it's pretty cool. I mean,
I will not
you
hide
probably
the fact
wouldn't hang
that
it in a museum, but you know.
I also have a child like that, who is still at a toddler's level, despite his age. But when I hang his pictures on the refrigerator, I don't think he's Leonardo da Vinci. I do it because I love
him. No, of course.
Not because of the work of art. See.
Of course.
Now,
but
a painting painted
but
by
there's a
blind
connection
person
something
might
special
be interesting
about it.
Because
yeah.
he has to overcome such a handicap to do the work. That could be interesting if you know he's blind. But art is supposed to speak for itself. Most modern art, you need to read the card to find out what the artist is trying to do. Whereas no one has to read the card to be impressed with the Mona Lisa. The Last Supper. Now, I have to admit, the Last Supper, if you know what the story is, it means more. Sure, you can learn more about the art in that way. And the same for classical music. If your ear is not attuned to it, you're not going to appreciate some of the things that Mozart or Bach did. But again, that's because I think the aesthetic faculty needs to be trained. And it can be trained for some forms of art and not for others. And again, part of this is cultural. It's like learning a language. All humans use language, but we don't all speak the same language. You know, does that mean language is in the ear of the beholder? Well, no. Some people speak clearly and precisely, even in translation, and others do not. Some people speak beautiful poetry, which is so good that even in translation, where the words don't have the same meaning and don't have the same connotations, it's still impressive. Okay?
Yep.
That's hard to do, because that means you're dealing not just with the lyricism of the words, not just with the connotations of the words, but with the actual abstract concepts themselves. That means you've reached the Platonic form of beauty, beauty in and of itself, if you understand.
Yeah. And that's, yes, if it translates, that's impressive. That's impressive in and of itself, because particularly something like poetry, which is inherently making use of metaphors and similes and things that don't generally translate
but also
well.
Lyricism and syllables and foot and so on and so forth. I read just a brilliant translation of Beowulf the other year recently. I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the translator, but an Irish fellow who had a really good ear for poetry in and of himself, and so he could translate and get some of the raw courage and some of the I'll just say masculine and virile rhythm of the original into his translation, you know. And I've read better and worse translations of you know other poets, and some people are just try to be really literal and they kind of lose the spirit, and some people try to get the spirit of it, but they really deviate from the literal meaning and they lose some of the nuances. So
and they well.
So again,
such as the
language does exist, and language does change from man to man, but language is not in the ear of the beholder. Language, if language was simply personal, if I just made up my own language for myself and said, well, you don't understand me because you don't speak John Wrightian, okay? I mean, I've done that in books. I've made up words in science fiction books that are allegedly people will use in the future that they don't use now, and I just hope that through the context the reader would get what I meant. But I don't...
Usually that's me
coining a term using the rules of language so as to still try to convey at least a hint or implication of what I mean. An artist can deviate from the rules.
Yeah.
An artist can deviate from the rules of what he's been brought up with. But he still has to use those rules, even in the omission, to try to communicate something. See? This art that communicates nothing, that means nothing, that's a scam. Even if he's not himself a fraud in terms of like money laundering, he's still cheating the reader or cheating the viewer or cheating the guy who came by to see the dance of his expectations. He held forth the promise that you were going to get a song, and instead he played one note and then had 20 minutes of silence. And I believe that is a real song. I can't think of the name, but there was an art performer who wrote a piece that was 10 minutes of music and 10 minutes of silence. And the guy sat there with his hands on his lap in front of a piano for 10 minutes. And then he got a round of applause.
I was going to say you paid to see a performance and then Yoko Ono came on stage.
Yep.
But
yep.
Same thing.
Same thing.
I was doing some research for this episode about the origins of modern art. It's worth noting that apparently modern art was picked up by the US government towards the end of World War II in their fight against communism. They actually bought a bunch of modern art pieces that they later sold for an average value of $50-ish, apparently, and took them on a road tour. And the purpose of it was to highlight how free artists were in the West. Like, look at what they are free to create in our free capitalist system, unlike the dour, oppressive communist system. Which strikes me as slightly odd, because it's just like saying, yes, our artists are free to make crap. That's how free we are.
I was just thinking of how many Soviet propaganda posters actually have good composition and draftsmanship, and I can at least tell what the person is supposed to be. But most modern art is late Victorian or World War I era. So you're talking about the CIA trying to use the modern art for propaganda?
Well, the U.S. government did it initially, mm-hmm. The State Department, I think, and then someone ran... You know how you get those stories today that it's like, look at what our bloody government is wasting stupid tax dollars on?
Yes, yes.
Someone ran one of those stories on it.
The Golden Fleece Award is what Senator Proxmire used to call it.
Ah, well, someone ran a story, that was the story that got told about it, so the State Department backed away from it, but the CIA ran with it. So apparently, the CIA got involved with spreading it, and the purpose was to demoralize the communists by showing how free our artists were to create what they wanted. Unfortunately, there's something wrong with our modern artists. Well, I mean, they've got degrees in art, that might be the problem. There was another meme I saw that summed it up nicely, I thought. For thousands of years, they created art, and it had Van Gogh's Starry Night and the Mona Lisa. I think it was the Mona Lisa, but it was definitely Van Gogh's Starry Night without degrees. And then artists with degrees came along, and it's a banana duct taped to a wall and something equally as garbage.
The banana duct taped to a wall is a real thing. It's a real art exhibit.
Well, it's an art exhibit.
Well, it's a sham. I mean, it's let's call it what it is. It's garbage meant to be a sham, meant to offend the bourgeoisie. It also has an economic element to it. When Adolphe Baudereau would draw a picture of Homer being led by a blind kid, Homer being led by a child, he would work for months on a painting. Okay,
that's
he
true.
Would use the most exquisite artistic effects of color and light that had been developed over decades and sometimes centuries to get the effects he wanted, including things like perspectival drawing, draftsmanship, studies of human anatomy, and on and on and on. Okay, he was highly skilled at what he did, and his works
are breathtakingly
beautiful. Then
yes.
The Impressionists did not stick to drawing things in a realistic way. They had a little more liberty, if you will, to draw things more impressionistically, hence the name, but it also didn't take as much time, and they didn't have to struggle with the lighting effects as well, and they didn't need to study anatomy. Then when you got into absurdism or cubism and dadaism or some of the drawings of Picasso, I saw a framed painting of Picasso hanging in a house when I was young and innocent, and it was a friend of mine, and he said, hey, what do you think of that picture? And I looked at it and I said, that's pretty good. Did your sister draw it? Because I thought it was something done by a child. Okay?
Yep.
Because it was like a sun with little irregular dots about it. You know, and I'm a cartoonist. I actually know what it takes to draw a sun to make it look like a sun. Okay?
Yep.
Now, Picasso is famous, and no one has ever seen any of my cartoons unless they, like, I don't know, read one of my wife's books, which I do the interior illustrations for. And my draftsmanship is mediocre at best, it's not as good as Jack King Kirby, let us say, who was a genius at cartoon.
Yep.
But how come I couldn't, even as a young age, I couldn't tell the difference between that and a child's drawing? That's Picasso. Well, he didn't, it was a black and white drawing, ink on paper, and it probably took him 10 minutes, maybe 15, as opposed to 10 months. And he gets the same price for it. So the economic incentive to go toward modern art, if you're going to get paid the same, is the same. Now, at that point, the common man can't tell the difference between a good painting and a poor one, because the art community has decided that non-representational art, abstract art, is the cat's pajamas. So who gets to decide what's art and what's junk? Well, the critics and the investors, the people running the establishment. So they merely pick something, one among their friends. They say, this is great art. They put it in the museums. They charge people to come in and look at it. They get a bunch of money and they hand it to that guy. And then he likewise helps perpetuate the system. And it's not done based on the artistic merit of the artist, because there's no merit involved at this point. It's just done based on the politics. It's just done based on the politics, and it's based on the politics of the artists. That's why they're all leftist these days. That's why it's almost impossible to find a right-wing painter whose work is hanging in a modern art museum. And from the modern arts, from the fine arts, it's also sneaked into popular entertainment, into movies, into science fiction books, into rock and roll songs, into rap music. You see, there's certain forms of art that just simply don't require as much work and effort as others. Now, this is not to say that a haiku, because it's only a short little poem, is easy to do. If done correctly, it requires genius. But a song that is just me shouting or chanting over and over again, making doggerel rhymes, does that actually require as much artistic concern and care as the polyphonic symphonies of Mozart with its artistic inversions and so on and so forth? You know, that where Mozart has to write out every note of every instrument in an opera or something, or Wagner, if I want to say opera. You see, the amount of care and craft that goes into this is also rewards disproportionately people with no skill once they adopt the philosophy of modernism. And please note, it's the same philosophy in music, in dance, in theater, in the fine arts, in poetry, in painting, and so on. You write poetry without rhyme or scan. You write experimental music without, without rhythm and without a meter. You write poems with no punctuation. You do dance that doesn't have any of the traditional ballet moves in it. You do painting that has no perspective, has no composition, has no chiaroscuro, isn't even a picture of something.
A
Well,
what?
it,
Chiaroscuro?
the
I
use
don't know what that
use
word is.
you don't use the light and shadow in order to produce an effect.
All
Okay,
right.
sorry, I didn't mean to get all
I
technical.
learned
I didn't mean to get all technical, and I'm probably mispronouncing the word
the
anyway. Okay,
word.
so the modern artist, the theory says that whenever I break a rule, this gives me more liberty to produce more beauty. But the reality is, the more rules you break, you're just left with chaos. Chaos is garbage. It is random elements tossed together as if in a trash compactor. You see?
Can I push back against you there a little
Certainly,
bit?
certainly.
I agree. I mean, I don't disagree
Wait,
that as you
before you
keep
push back,
breaking.
let me make a clear distinction. I believe that
Sure.
artistic tradition can change organically within the tradition. Okay? So that if you want to write something that's not a sonnet but has more lines or less, or if you want to write Milton's poem didn't rhyme, you know, that
Yep.
you're not shackled to it, you're not bound to it. But the difference between an organic change within the tradition is that it respects the former tradition and still aiming at the same transcendental beauty, whereas the violent eruption of merely breaking the tradition is from outside the tradition. That's not a heresy, that's just infidelity. That's not a new thing, that's just destroying an old thing. So with that distinction in mind, now feel free to push back, because what I said is controversial.
Okay, no, I was going to note, it reminds me of what they say about wealth. The first generation makes the wealth, the second generation continues and lives on the wealth, and then the third generation will squander it. Like, for a company, like, the first guy will build it, his sons will run it, and then his grandsons will not under... His sons will have grown up with it and understand the company, but the grandsons... Or the sons understand the company, but the grandsons don't.
In America, don't we have a saying, or we used to have it. Blue collar to white collar in one generation, back to blue collar in the third generation. You know.
There we go. But maybe, and this seems to be true of our political elites as well. The would be planners of the world had some idea of what they're doing, but we're living with their grandchildren today who are just clueless. Who are dangerously clueless, but equally as delusional. I'm wondering, is maybe this true of some of the modern art movements? The people that did it first knew what they were doing and actually created something. Like, I don't know. I like Salvador Dali's melting clock painting. It's interesting to me. It's an interesting work of art. But now we're living with the grandchildren of.
Imagine being a child and brought into a modern art museum, or even a modern art museum in the, let's say, in the 60s or the 50s, and mm-hmm. you saw things that were visual gibberish that you could do, but all the adults said, this is true art, this is glorious, this is beautiful. So, being a child, you went, yeah, sure, that's what's beautiful. And when you asked them about it, they told you that it was due to your internal emotional reaction. And they said beauty is not the beholder. They taught you that it's if you think it's art. See? So then you, as an artist, let's say you're a child and then you grow up, and you don't, you're not the first generation. You're not the ones who saw what the rebellion against the Victorian standards were. Because they were trying to do some things to escape what they regarded as restriction. I myself regard the traditions of law, of art, as being like a bridge, not like a wall. But then again, I'm a traditionalist by my nature. I like ancient, you know, epics and stuff. I like Homer.
Yep.
And you can't get much older than Homer unless you're going to read the Mahabharata. Okay. But that's a matter of taste. That's not a matter of aesthetic appeal. There are things like Salvador Dali's work, especially his like four-dimensional crucifixion of Christ, where he combines elements of a hypercube into his art, which is actually rather cunning, rather clever. And he knows how to do color and shading, and he knows how to block out light and shadow and do perspective and so on and so forth. He actually has the skill of an artist.
He knows how to do it properly.
He knows how to do it properly. So it's in his case it's deliberate. Okay, and in his case he's deliberately deviating from it to try to produce an effect. But he's first generation. Okay, the guys who built the company. Second generation, if you're raised merely to be told that art is whatever you call art, then you simply will take a piece of paper and throw a paint can at it. But if you do it with sufficient, you'll think it has to do with like your energy, your internal vehemence, your sincerity, the authenticity with which you throw the paint can at the canvas, and that if you draw something that looks good, like a Maxfield Parrish painting, you know, then you're a sellout. You're doing it for money. You're not a member of the elite.
Yep.
You're not a member of the superior race, because the superior race can see. I shouldn't say superior race, the superior cult. Because the superior cult can see beauty where there's no beauty to be seen. Because you are like a guy who can see invisible things because of your inner knowledge and your inner certainty. You're an artist by your own self-declaration. Now,
they can see the emperor's fine robes.
Fine robes. Now, notice that this is similar to the something we discussed on our previous episode called Gnosticism. Gnosticism is the theory that supernatural reality is open to the Gnostics, to those who know. That's what the word means. Gnostic means those who know. Our word for prognosis or diagnosis comes from the word Gnostic. They have a inner ineffable knowledge. They have a secret knowledge that they can't impart to other people that sets them apart from and above the lower people who don't, you know, the pneumatic people, the somatic people, they have special words for inferior people, okay?
Yeah, well.
You see this reflected in politics, especially in left-wing politics, where they think that they don't need rules of economics to run an economy. They'll run it by their own inner authentic knowledge. You see, they don't need logic to tell them what to interpret a work of art. They'll just deconstruct it based on their own internal secret knowledge. Well, the artist falls into this same camp. It's the same lazy and proud thinking, because the Gnostic thinks that the man is God, and that man can really decree yep. himself to be good and doesn't need to obey moral rules. Well, look at the parallel between that and the artist who says, I am the artist, I am the creator, I can decree what is beautiful, and I no longer need to follow the rules of art. I no longer need to use nature as my guide. Art does not come from nature for the Gnostic. Art comes from my internal light, my internal Godhead, and I can create ex nihilo. I can create something with no precedent, see? The psychology, I submit, is the same across all these fields. And it's one of the mountains of madness that this podcast is meant to criticize, is meant to oppose.
Yes.
Because art is one of those mountains. Modern art has turned into a mountain of garbage.
It has. So, I guess that brings us to the all-important question. Short of going to the museums and burning it all, what can be done?
Well, maybe that's a good place to start. Let's not get involved in either or. Let's think of both and.
Okay.
After we're done burning the art museums and yep. getting the pornography out of our schools, we need to return to the common man. Because please notice that you can go into a theater, not to an artsy-fartsy film, but to a film that was meant to be released to the general public, and see, mm-hmm. let's take James Cameron's Avatar. Part of the appeal of that film was the breathtaking beauty of the imagined foreign world of Pandora in three dimensions.
He spent
lavish amounts of time and special effects trying to get that thing to look good. Okay?
Yes.
And, or if you watch, there's a filmmaker named Joe Wright, who I watch only because he's got my last name, who did a revised version of Pride and Prejudice. And I really liked it. I thought it was simply visually gorgeous to the eye. It was simply splendid. We talked about the movie Lord of the Rings. Part of the appeal of that movie was the sheer sublime beauty of the landscape of New Zealand, which we now know is Middle Earth. You see, it looked like a fairy tale kingdom, because that New Zealand actually, I mean, no offense to my New Zealand friends, but it actually is a fairy tale kingdom. It's one of the most beautiful spots of land on the planet. You see.
And now it's ruled by Sauron.
Yes, well, I mean, there is that, but what's I her name? But that's for another episode.
Adam.
But the common man, when modern art turned bad, the common man still had things like calendars, record labels, record covers, you know, mm-hmm. comic books. There were still posters, movie posters. There were still things we hung on our walls that were appealing to the eye, that visually made sense, and that were quite striking. Not all of them were traditional representational art. You don't have to be, you know, it's not supposed to be a straitjacket. It's supposed to be a bridge, like I said, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are still good looking. Even badly made films sometimes have some of the best art direction you'll ever see. So there's still a hunger, there's still a craving in the human soul for beauty. It will always be there, you see. You can't just train people out of it. The moderns think that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. They think it's a matter of cultural conditioning. If they were correct, they could culturally condition people to appreciate the beauty in ugliness. And they have tried. And it has not worked. You see? Now, let me also mention, I think there's a more sinister aspect to this whole thing. I think there's a conspiracy, similar to what you said about the CIA. If you surround a man with ugliness, if he lives in a hovel with peeling wallpaper and bugs on the walls, and a bureaucrat comes to him and tells him to do something which is humiliating, like pee in a cup or have his anal apertures be examined for smuggling, who is more likely to give in? A guy who lives in the hovel, or a guy who lives surrounded by breathtaking beauty, columns of gold with heroic statues on top, with a mosaic of the greatness of saints and heroes in the background, with a stained glass window showing something divine? Who's gonna have a lower opinion of mankind and of himself? Someone surrounded by beauty, or someone surrounded by ugliness? Ugliness saps the soul. It weakens you.
Well, that would explain modern architecture. Ugh.
Modern architecture is called brutalist because it's meant to be brutalizing. It's meant to oppress
some
the
of
soul.
It is.
The brutalist school is, let us say.
No, that certainly is. But there's other modern art. There's other modern architecture that just seems designed to deliberately uglify the landscape.
Yes.
Like they're hideous and they don't fit. But anyway.
We haven't touched on the theory that I've heard someone say. I believe it was Ayn Rand, a woman who I agree with on several points but disagree sharply on others, who thought that your artistic expression was always an externalization of your internal reality. It was your view of life summed up and manifested, made incarnate in one striking image or song or story.
Hmm.
If so, the ugliness of these artists is because of their internal ugliness.
Or the ugliness of their souls.
Right. They're wretched, neurotic people. And they want to spread it. Misery loves company.
I've met lots of writers. They all seem to be crazy, neurotic people. Even writers I like. I mean, even you.
I don't strike myself as being crazy or neurotic, but then again, if I were crazy, how would I know?
All of the writers I know seem to be driven to tell stories. Like, they'll go mad if they don't. So,
oh, that's a different thing. If you
there's
if
something
you
in them that's like driving them mad.
But I know priests who were driven to join the priesthood who would go mad if they didn't. I know lovers who are driven to get married to the woman they love who will go mad if they don't. That's because artists are partially mad because we're in love with the muse. You see. That's a different type of madness. That's not neurosis.
Ah, fair enough.
That's a divine madness. That's a madness that brings beauty.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe these other artists are following a different muse. A more sulfurous muse.
It's the muse of hell. Yes. They're following the muse of ugliness because they're filled with bitterness and resentment. And you can see it. You can see it in their works.
Well, that brings me back to the Screwtape Letters of C.S. Lewis, actually. He talks about Screwtape is saying, oh, well, they have beauty and they have silence, but what we have, and they have music and they have silence, but what we have in hell is noise, glorious noise.
I'm a little old-fashioned, so that's my opinion of rock and roll concerts, you know. Noise, glorious noise. Though, honestly, if you listen to it, if you analyze it, there's rhythm to it, and there's chord changes, and there's the other things that you need to have a nice, good, you know, dance music. It's there.
And some of it actually does achieve
artistic merit, you know.
I mean, yes, I'm a little younger than you, and something of a metalhead, so yes. I appreciate the artist. There's a lot of artistry that goes into a lot of this music. Sadly, so much of it is tainted with corrupted imagery. But
yeah, it's there's satanic imagery.
There's still artistry there. Yeah, there's still artistry in a lot of it.
Sure,
I try to steer away from that. But yeah.
But even metal, rock and roll, drums and trumpets and loud noises are supposed to be part of the music of war. You know, it's a type of music that's meant to be challenging. It's meant to harness a rather dramatic and brave part of the soul, you see, and to get your heart pumping. So there's still some artistry to it, though it's not trying for the delicacy of a butterfly. It's trying to capture the sensation of an avalanche, you know, or a volcano or something, you see. Or better yet, a group of hussars, winged hussars, rushing onto the Paynims in a battle and stabbing them to death, you know, in a great glorious military victory, because there's a song called by a group called I think it's Sabaton that concerns the winged hussars that even I have to admire. But again, that's a matter of taste. That's not a matter of whether it's artistic or not. And again, we have to say that there's things below art as well as above art. There are things that are just decoration. I don't have anything against comic books. I think that I'm not going to call them great art, but I'm going to say that they are they're wholesome and they're healthy and there's something good about them. But not anymore. Once upon a time, stories about Superman would uplift a child's imagination because he was a hero who demanded no reward. But that's a story for another day. My point here is that even comic books were well drawn. Okay, they tried to look good. Even dance music, simple fiddle music, simple rock and roll music is meant to dance music. It's pleasant. It's meant to be pleasant. It's decoration. It's meant to make our lives a little less difficult because something pleasant is around us.
Yes. So it brings us back to the question: once we've burned the music, once we've burned the museums of modern art, what can we do to fix the problem?
Easy peasy. Repent in prayer and ashes, return to God, ask for inspiration, and go back to the common man. Go and find something that ordinary people with ordinary tastes like. Because here's something I found out in my youth. There's nothing in a great book that's not also in a good book. So the same thing that's in a Harlequin romance is also in Gone with the Wind, but there's more of it, okay? It's better done.
Mm-hmm.
So trust the common man and trust his taste and then build on it and look at your ancestors and look at what they did. And, I mean, no modern building can match the Cathedral at Notre Dame, which is why they burned it. It's simply more beautiful than what we can do these days because our tastes have been corrupted.
Well, more cathedrals and great paintings and less bananas taped to walls.
Yeah, and also you'd also have to change the economic incentives and you'd have to break up the money laundering schemes, which is with a RICO. So some people deserve to be in jail, at certain points.
Yes. Well, on that note, thank you everyone for joining us today on this episode of Against the Mountains of Madness. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, and we'll be back in a week. Thank you for joining me, John.
Thank you for joining me.